We are going to travel back in time to the end of the 18th century to find out more about the history of this unique and vital spot in the industrial past of Lugos a Mariña, or Coastal Zone. During our tour, we will be listening to the voice of Antonio Ibáñez, the developer behind the industrial complex, as well as other witnesses of that time, comparing their accounts of what happened during the attack of the smelting factory in April 1798. Before we begin the tour, it is important to follow these instructions. Once the recording has begun, do not interrupt it until it ends, and keep to the instructions given to follow the route correctly. Stop only when asked to do so in the recording, and above all, walk at a slow and steady pace. Our starting point will be at the front of the outer door of the History Museum.
Today, we are going to discover the enclave where Galicia's first industrial complex was developed by a private individual to supply the civilian market. We will visit the historical industrial buildings that form a part of the smelting factory built in Sargadelos between 1791 and 1794, made up of a blast furnace, hammer, and other units, charcoal piles, carpentry workshop, forges, storage rooms, houses for the workers, and a main house, dams and water channels. We are now in front of what used to be the complex management house. The project's developer was Antonio Raimundo Ibáñez, and the smelting factory remained in operation up until 1875, more or less continuously. What this tour aims to do is to take us back in time to the end of the 18th century, allowing us to understand the impact Ibáñez's industrial project had on the society of the time through the eyewitness accounts of some of the leading figures. But before we start walking, let's begin by listening to the lead character.
I was named Antonio Raimundo Ibáñez Gastón de Isaba Llano y Valdés, and I bore the title of Marquis. But for me, personally and historically, I'm quite simply Antonio Ibáñez, born in Los Oscos and a resident of Ribadeo. Working in trade, I brought foreign products that could not be found in this country through this port. Brandies and liqueurs from Catalonia, linen from Russia, steel from Sweden, cod from Newfoundland, pots from Bordeaux. But I know only too well that trade consists of more than simply buying products abroad. Industry has to be active, natural, and proportional to the circumstances of the territory, harnessing all of the assets it might have to the advantage of local craftsmanship. Inspired by these and other patriotic sentiments, I proposed building new ironworks to replace the old blacksmiths, to make iron plates, boilers, nuts and bolts, anchors, and all type of ironwork. It could never be rightly alleged that the proposed complex was harmful to the country or the prosperity of the land. Such an axiom, often adopted by the rusticity of the local inhabitant, and commonly spread by the fanaticism of the rich man, would be deceptive. An initial consultation with the residents of Santa Maria de Rua did nothing to alleviate the detestable giant of envy, nor, once the agreement was given, asking for permission and receiving a royal license to establish one or more ironworks with the hammers and an iron pot factory. No. Because to progress, I became entangled in a costly legal battle with wealthy landowners, the Navy Commissioner of Viveiro, Mondoñedo Town Council, and even the delegate of the realm in the court, all of whom fiercely opposed my proposals to modernize our industry skills. Their petitions did not have the success they would have wanted, but many were those who continued to secretly sabotage the transportation of wood and the progress of the factory. Among the Jove parish priest, the chaplain of As Maravillas, the priest Luis Antonio Salgado and Antonio Varela, and other members of the clergy, allied to Don Diego Pardo, Don Antonio de Cora, Don Manuel Antonio Pedrosa, and other owners and renowned figures with influence and power, not only in this province, but also in A Coruña and in the court in Madrid.
In proceedings initiated against Ibáñez's request to build a factory, some local chiefs alleged that the countryside could be impoverished by exhausting the tree reserves. They also accused Ibáñez of having ruined the area with the imports of linen and of acting solely in his own interest to increase his wealth. But behind these allegations, what can really be seen is the reaction of a social system in which the basis of power lies in land ownership, which belongs to a few, in the face of the changes that industrialization would necessarily bring. Because the people employed in the factory would have greater autonomy in their lives, away from the control of the landowners. The hostility shown towards Ibáñez only became more intense after the proceedings were settled in his favor and the factory began to operate. For several years, different incidents occurred. Deliberate fires, revolts against official orders sent to make the necessary deliveries of coal, and constant threats against Ibáñez. All of this came to a head on 30 April 1798, when an organized attack on the factory took place. So, now that we have set the scene, we can begin our tour. We are going to stand with our backs to Management House and then walk down the footpath on the right-hand side of the road.
Every time I pass by my house, I remember that Monday, 30th of April 1798, when a large crowd of men and women from nearby towns and villages, prompted by certain leaders behind the riot, came armed with sickles, sticks, swords, and some even with guns. They overran the factories, destroyed, burgled, and set fire to the main house, the houses of the workers, the furnace and ironworks with all its offices, the forges, storm rooms for provisions, tools, molds, utensils, files, and anything that could be moved. Not even the doors and the windows of the houses, and chalices and chapel also were left behind.
Careful, because we have to cross the road just when we reach the gate of the management house's garden. Wait until no cars are coming, cross the road and walk towards those directly lit houses on the other side. We are going to stop when we get to the first house, before continuing along the street that goes straight ahead. This was the residential area for the factory workers and their families. The first house on the right, the one with the wooden door, was the inn, with accommodation and a canteen. And in front of us is the Calle del Medio, a road that is in keeping with 18th century town planning and one of the first to be associated with an industrial estate. Here we have a street with its pavements and houses on either side, which is what provides the complex overall with much needed habitability, because a center of production is inextricably linked to a center of life as people work and live here. The workers and their families establish their residence here, some in this street, others in wooden houses that have long since disappeared, but evidence of which can be seen by the place names of the surroundings, where we can find the neighborhood of the English or the neighborhood of the Heads. As you can see, the houses on Calle del Medio did not escape the fury of the attackers. Now we are going to continue walking slowly. And when we get to the end of the street, we'll make another stop.
I'm Roque Gómez, 31 years of age, originally from Mondoñedo and a resident of Sargadelos, employed as a molder at the iron works. On 30 April, it must have been about 2 in the afternoon, we heard the bells of the church in Thelbo ringing, as well as other farther afield. Then we heard horn sounding and the beating of drums from a sizable hand. The noise was getting closer to the factories and they appeared to be coming for us. Hundreds of people were advancing upon us, shouting, "Death to Ibáñez! Death to Ibáñez!" Surprised by such a disturbance, we offered no resistance, unarmed as we were, while they had sickles, sticks and spikes and were striking out at everything and throwing stones as well. We ran to safety and only went back a day later. I don't understand such a level of destruction, as the factories provide sustenance, a home and work for many men, women and families. And now we have gained knowledge of the skills we need, and our work has a value that it didn't have before.
Remember to stop at the end of the street. When you pass by the last house, you'll see some steps which lead to another open space. Enclosed by walls on the left-hand side and at the back, and by a water channel on the right. Just there on the right, you'll see a stone arch. If you like, you can walk over there, but don't cross the small wooden bridge over the channel just yet. So, all of this area was occupied by the furnace, which is completely in ruins today, as you can see. The stone arch was beside the bellows that blasted air into the furnace, which was moved hydraulically. That was one of the rioters' main objectives.
I'm Julio Rey, a farmer by occupation and resident of Trasvar in the parish of Santa Maria de Rua. I declare that, having always lived on these lands until the establishment of the ironworks that Ibáñez installed in Sargadelos, we have never been subjected to persecution, seizure and obligations, and in such quick succession to comply with coal deliveries, which were claimed to be running late. We can't let the livestock roam free in the woods, or collect wood whenever we want, as we've always done. They force us to haul everything using our carts and cows and arms, and not in service to the king as they would have you believe, but to bring more riches to the owner of the factories. Everyone from around these parts knows that there are flat-bottom boats in San Cibrao loaded with the munition to be shipped to France and not to the arsenal in Ferrol. It was better to burn the factory, because we're not going to tolerate it, even if ordered by the king. That's why we banded together, people from Rua, Cervo, Castelo, San Román, Burela, Nois, and even Valadouro and Mondoñedo. Called to action through letters, by emissaries, or by people shouting about it on market day, urging us to march to the factories. And yes, we were called to gather as a hunting party on 30 April, or be fined for 4 ducats to boost the numbers. All in all, there were more than 4,000 of us, and it would have been 2 in the afternoon when the march began. The first thing we did when we got there was to set fire to the furnace below to stop it from working. Then some groups went to the King's Gunpowder Warehouse and others to the workshops, where they were met with some resistance, as well as to the main house in order to capture the owner. But such was the fury that people started spreading out all over the factory, uncontrolled and without really knowing what they were doing.
Now it's time to cross a little wooden bridge over the channel to get to the building on the other side, on the right. We'll make another stop there. Let's go. The house is called Casa de las Máquinas, or House of the Machines. Once the pieces had been made, after the smelting process, this is where they were assembled. From architectural elements such as balusters to stoves, cookers, pots, mortars, steam pumps, as well as bilge pumps for boats, later water and gas conduction pipes. Well, here in this workshop was where the first direct confrontation with the attackers took place. Let's listen to some of the eyewitnesses.
My name is Thomas Morland, and I am a Capuchin friar. I came here from France, fleeing from the revolution, and was generously taken in by Antonio Ibáñez throughout the intersection of the Bishop of Mondoñedo, for whatever service might be necessary in his home or in the factory. Having fled my country, I prayed never to experience again the events that forced me to leave. And on 30th April, I saw myself surrounded once again by a violent murderous mob that I will never forget. I heard drums and horns and shouting, so I headed straight for the workshops where I found Francisco Acevedo, Ibáñez's brother-in-law, and Lieutenant Ruiz de Cortázar with members of the guard posted at the factory. Given the lieutenant's failure to act, it was Acevedo who sent me outside to plead with them to stop and find out what it was they wanted. Confident that my religious garments would make them refrain from further action. I had hardly opened my mouth to speak when I was struck by a crowd. My head is split open and my breviary stolen. I fell to the ground, but was still able to see how the crowd were throwing stones against the troops and workers positioned there. As soon as one soldier was injured, the officer ordered his men to fire into the air, but some of them aimed at the crowd, and the gunfire was returned, leading to one death and many, many injuries.
Let's continue our walk. First of all, please stand with your backs to the Casa de las Máquinas. Now let's move on. Look out for an opening in a low wall in front of you, slightly to the left. Can you see it? Please pass through it. You are now entering an area where you will see stone tables with benches. Can you see it? Go over to the table just in front of the barbecue, a little to your right. We'll stop here for a moment. You can sit down if you want, if there are places free. The important thing is to keep looking towards the road behind the barbecue. On the other side, you will see a long stone ground floor building. That was where they store the manufactured goods, designed in such a way as to let very little natural light through, yet allow the carts to enter and exit. Those warehouses also served as accommodation for soldiers and stables for horses from the Prince's Regiment, posed at Sargadelos as guard shortly after the ironworks started working exclusively to supply the army with weapons and ammunition in 1794. Strangely enough, during the events of 30 April in 1798, the presence of this military detachment was not able to stop the attack.
I speak for myself, Francisco Ruiz de Cortázar, lieutenant in command of the Prince's Regiment, posted to protect the Royal Munitions Factory at Sargadelos. The first shot was fired by one of the rioters, whose name we learned of after his detention, Manuel Motin.
Then I ordered my troops to fire into the air, also to stop the mob from pelting us with stones. There were shots fired on both sides, with 6 people injured and 1 dead. The fatality being one Thomas de Vigna, who had been shot in the chest. Initially, the death of one of their own seemed to calm the rioters, who asked to speak to Francisco Acevedo, the person in charge of the factory. As soon as he appeared, he was pelted with stones and beaten with sticks. He had to be rescued by the factory workers, while I was trying to bring my troops to order to prevent further bloodshed. We remained on high alert for several hours, protecting the Crown's munitions and witnessing scenes of pillage. Until at some time after 10 that night, when Bernardino Tejada, the commander from Viveiro, arrived with the 3rd African Battalion. It was the dark of night by then, and only a few drunken individuals remained, who were persuaded by His Excellency that justice would be done for any oppression they had suffered throughout the fault of Ibáñez. And that was enough to make them leave without any further upheaval.
I am Rita Fernández, a widow from Cordido. On 30 April, I was at the Sarga de los factory, along with some other local women, having been urged to take part in the demonstration by people at Cordido Market who were marching to demand that the factory stop using coal wagons at harvest time. These were just some of the abuses that were happening to many of those in the area. And all anyone was talking about was this Ibáñez, who is the owner of the factories. And it wasn't just in people's homes, or on the road, or at the market. I even heard the priest himself say at mass that at night Ibáñez broke into ladies' and children's rooms to steal their blood, that he kidnapped a man every week and cooked him in a well for the extract, for occult use in the steelworks. A man capable of such evil surely deserves to die on that evidence alone. When we arrived at the factory, the first to start shooting were the soldiers. Some of those beside me were hit and fell. Then I was hit too. The doctor who treated me said he thought I was going to die. I spent a day at home, and as I didn't have anything to eat, I had to go out and look for food. With the effort it took to walk for miles, the wound opened up, and that's how it is now, with me not able to fend for myself or eat, and accused of rebellion and arson, and God knows how many other things I can't defend myself against.
All right, we can move on now. We are going to turn towards the left and continue walking until we get to the last stone table, and then we'll make another stop. If you keep looking at the road, you'll see a stone building on the other side that has been restored, slightly higher and with a slate roof. Can you see it? That was the factory's coal cellar, where they kept the charcoal needed to feed the furnace. Ibáñez himself is going to explain it to us much better.
The coal cellars and the iron works, along with the dam and the canal, were the initial construction works I had carried out in 1791, under a contract signed with the master builder Cosme Álvarez from San Pedro de Cangas. As I was from Oscos, a land of many iron works, I know that charcoal made from oak wood made better iron, and I wanted to bring this innovation to Sargadelos, where the coal merchants only manufactured the traditional heather charcoal. It was necessary to bring not only architects from Vizcaya for the ironworks, and people with knowledge of manufacturing cast iron from Navarre, but also a significant number of workers from the Basque Country, Navarre and Asturias, for the charcoal piles and others for working in the mines. There's no ironworks without coal, or munitions either. The war declared against France in 1793 made it necessary to make munitions here for the Crown. Deliveries were immediate and constant, and I had to request the necessary carriage of coal to meet that demand, a right that had been granted to me in 1792, and that I did not avail until the end of 1794. I wanted to avoid the obligatory carriages by bringing carters from Asturias, and I myself provided 12 pairs of oxen with their corresponding wagons, which were the ones that had kept the ironworks going up until then. I could have increased that number, but the countryside lacks the pasture to allow for it, and the locals don't want to sell them either. A throwback to the resentment still borne by the noblemen after losing the earlier legal battle. And finally, the obligation with regard to the carriages was necessary to comply with the orders from the king's army.
We can continue our tour now. I'm going to show you the kilns. Turn to your left, leaving the charcoal piles behind you, and continue ahead. Cross a wide path with grass over the canal, and a little further ahead, we'll see the remains of the furnace in that stone wall with six small gaps in the bottom. Can you see it? That's perfect. We'll stop over there just in front of it. The initial process in the smelting of the metal took place in this furnace, which was calcination. When the iron ore came from the mine, it wasn't ready to be smelted. It had to be calcined and cleaned first. On top of those stone arches, on the inside, there's a large vessel which was filled with superimposed layers of charcoal and iron ore. Then it was set fire to and let for a time to burn. The iron that would be taken for smelting would end up in the bottom of the vessel, and everything else could be reduced to ash and deposited in the ash trays, which are those open gaps you can see below the arches. If you want, when we finish our tour, you can climb up the back, and from the top, you can see those two large vessels I was talking about. For now, we have to move on. The idea is to go as far as the dam that was made on the River Xunco in 1791. And to get there, we have to follow a path that everyone calls Lover's Way. We can't miss it, so let's go. We are going to double back across the grass path over the canal again, and straight after turn to the left onto a track that runs alongside the canal, which will be on our left. The canal runs from the dam, which we will come across at the end of the path up to the management house, where there is another small waterfall that takes the water back to the River Xunco. As such, the dam and the canal are hydraulic and were built to serve the metal works, as were some of the mills that are still preserved today along the course of the river a little farther downstream between Sargadelos and Cervo. Back then, industrial production enclaves were integrated in the territory where they could avail of the natural resources in order to operate, in this case, wood, water and stone. Natural spaces were exploited, but also looked after as production depended on their proper maintenance. For example, if you look over to the right, on the other side of the road, down at the end, among the trees, you will see a stone fountain from that time. But let's return to the revolt of 1798. After the events of 30 April, the Royal Court of Galicia ordered the initiation of legal proceedings. More than 500 local residents were charged, and Antonio de Cora, Manuel Pedrosa, and a further 18 local chiefs were summoned as the main instigators.
My name is Manuel Antonio Pedrosa Arias, owner of the Pedrosa estate and land, lord of the towers of Villariz and Cordido in the Bishopric of Mondoñedo, and resident of the parish of Santa Maria del Lieiro. I should say that no evidence exists against me or the others accused of the same crime, that is, having taken part in any activities that might have put the life of the Sargadelos factory owner in danger. These baseless accusations that this Ibáñez has made against me only deflect from the true causes behind what occurred on 30 April, which are none other than the outrages committed by this individual. It so happens that having been granted a license to install a hammer, he built a furnace under the guise of such a license, and taking advantage of the supposed royal status of the factory and the above-mentioned hammer and furnace, and abusing the power and room for maneuver afforded him by his privilege, he extended the prerogatives of said privilege to the extent that he became the absolute owner of the lives and estates of the local residents, using such harsh and violent means that it seemed his only desire was to momentarily exterminate them. In this state of affliction and despondency brought on by the humiliation suffered at the hands of Ibáñez, and without recourse in the kingdom of magistrates to protect and help them, they decided to confront him or his representative at Sargadelos on 30 April that year, to demand the payments that had been held back and that the harsh measures in place be relaxed. But where they were expecting a massive response in line with the Christian sentiments of reason and justice, they found only wretched boos, mockery and scorn, and obscene provocations. And what is more, they were further disrespected by a barrage of bullets and grenades, resulting in one person dying and many more being injured, some seriously.
The attacks were relentless. And in the days following the riot, they set fire to the coal stocks in the countryside, destroying the tile factory, ill-treating, chasing, and driving away the Basque and Asturian coal workers. The same with all of those who depend on the factory, putting up seditious posters and putting a price on my life. This is the evidence that has been admitted to proceedings. And there is more, which I'm not going to mention. I'm not going to waste any more time responding to insults and lies. It is enough to remember what they heard the scribe Santos saying only days after the riot. The demonstration called for the 30 April was badly thought out. Because if Ibáñez had died, the same fate would have befallen him as the spider in the saying, that without the spider, there is no yarn. They wanted to kill me. There's no doubt about that. But all they did was destroy the yarn. And me, well, I'm the spider, and I'm still very much alive, and I will build another web.
We are coming to the end of Lover's Way by the River Xunco Dam, one of the first construction carried out in 1791 in preparation for the establishment of the Sargadelos Iron Works. This is where our tour ends. You can go over to that little stone vantage point in front of you to see the dam and the waterfall better. All that remains to be said is that in the end, the legal proceedings brought about by the riot were resolved by a notarial deed of conciliation signed by the instigators and Ibáñez and endorsed by Carlos IV in February 1803. Among other stipulations, they agreed that both the terms of instigators, driving forces behind the revolt, and other labels used by Don Antonio Raimundo Ibáñez against Don Manuel Pedrosa, as well as the terms used by the latter to describe the former, such as oppressor, tyrant, and other such derogatory words, will have no value or effect and will be erased in all parts of this process. Presumably, Ibáñez did not come off too badly, and the local chiefs had to pay a lot less than they might have had to for the destruction of the factory. But it's possible that the conflict did not end there, as just a few years later, in 1809, Ibáñez was killed in Ribadeo by another mob while attacking and burgling his home. Thank you very much for accompanying me on this tour. To get back to the factory, you can take the same path we came on, or follow the botanical trail, which you can see going up to the left.
Don't forget to return the headphones to the same place you collected them. The characters of this audio guide were played by order of appearance by Patricia de Lorenzo, Dani Trillo, Borja Fernández, Iván Marcos, and Arancha Villar. Editing and audio post-production by Jacobe Martínez Antelo. Documentation and texts by Jesús Ron. This audio guide would not have been possible without the help of Elisa Pérez, Camilo Díaz, and the staff at Cerro Town Council.